Mickey Strong, and this is VOA 1, The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak. This program is designed for English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
On today's program, Brian Lynn explains why some American businesses are no longer selling lobster. Faith Perlow presents a new everyday grammar report. We close with the next part of our U.S. history series. But first, here is Brian Lynn.
Some American businesses have stopped selling lobster because of concerns that fishing methods could harm endangered whales. Several food companies announced they had removed lobster offerings to the public. The removals came after a conservation group said it had added the American and Canadian lobster fisheries to its red list. It is a list of species to avoid when buying seafood. The organization that makes the list is called Seafood Watch. It is based at the Monterey Bay Aquarium in Northern California. Seafood Watch said in a new report that the fishing industry is a danger to North Atlantic right whales. The whales can suffer injury or death when they become trapped in equipment that connects lobster traps to the ocean floor. The organization's report said that current management measures do not go far enough to prevent such risks and to support efforts to save the whale species. Thousands of businesses use Seafood Watch's guidelines to make buying decisions. Many have already promised to avoid any products that appear on the red list. A spokesperson for Blue Apron, a New York-based food seller, said the company had already stopped offering a seasonal lobster box before the report came out. The company said all the seafood it currently uses follows Seafood Watch's guidelines. German meal kit seller HelloFresh also promised shortly after the announcement to stop selling lobster. In a statement, a spokesperson said the company is committed to following the Seafood Watch guidelines. Seafood Watch rates more than 2,000 seafood products as best choice, good alternative, and avoid. The ratings are based on how sustainably the products are harvested or fished. The organization's guidelines have been influential in the past. It red-listed shrimp fishing operations in the southern state of Louisiana. That action led to increased conservation efforts to better protect sea turtles. The fishery was later removed from the red list. The lobster fishing industry has been under pressure from Seafood Watch in recent years because of the threat of entanglement in fishing equipment. Experts say there are fewer than 340 North Atlantic right whales. Entanglement is one of the two biggest threats they face, scientists and conservation groups say. Another threat is the danger of crashes with ships. The population of the giant animals was greatly harmed by intensive whaling generations ago. Whale numbers have also decreased in recent years. Members of the lobster fishing industry disagreed with the Seafood Watch rating. The director of the Maine Lobstermen's Association, Patrice McCarran, told the Associated Press that no interaction between the lobster industry and right whales had been recorded in the northeastern state in nearly 20 years. Lobster is one of the most sustainable fisheries in the world due to the effective stewardship practices handed down through generations of lobstermen, McCarran said. She added that this has included strong protections for both the lobster resource and right whales. American and Canadian lobster fishermen target the same species, the American lobster. This species is popular as live seafood and is also used in processed products such as lobster rolls and lobster ravioli. A large majority of the world's American lobster is harvested in New England and eastern Canada. I'm Brian Lynn.
Think about a time you talked about a favorite character in a book you had read. Maybe you spoke about the character in a literature class at school. Or perhaps you discussed the character with a friend or in a book group. How did you do it? Did you describe what they looked like? Did you tell what the character did in the story? Did you talk about why you liked the character? In today's Everyday Grammar, we will discuss one of my favorite characters, Mrs. Frisbee. She is from the children's book, Mrs. Frisbee and the Rats of Nim, by Robert C. O'Brien. Mrs. Frisbee is a field mouse and a mother. Her mate, father to their children, has died. Mrs. Frisbee needs help moving her family to their summer home. This week, we will consider a few areas when looking at Miss Frisbee: the character's appearance or looks, and her thoughts and speech. In a future Everyday Grammar, we will look at her actions and how other characters think about her. Often, story writers use descriptive language, such as adjectives, to provide a mental picture of the character's appearance. Let us look at how Robert C. O'Brien describes Mrs. Frisbee's appearance.
With her forepaws and sharp teeth, she pulled off a part of the husk from the top ear of corn.
Here, O'Brien describes Mrs. Frisbee's physical appearance while she is actively seeking food for her children. Forepaws is a compound noun. Fore means front in this case. Paws are the animal's feet. Mrs. Frisbee's front teeth are described with the adjective sharp. When I think of Mrs. Frisbee's physical appearance, I picture a small, light brown mouse with a white stomach. Another way to describe a character is through the thoughts and feelings of the character and what they say. In one event, Mrs. Frisbee tries to save Jeremy, a crow or blackbird, who tied himself up in a fence. The two of them are in discussion. Mrs. Frisbee.
Why did you pick up the string?
The crow, who was very young indeed, in fact only a year old, said,
Because it was shiny.
Mrs. Frisbee.
You knew better. Come down here,
she said.
I'll get the string off.
How?
Said the crow.
Don't argue. I have only a few minutes.
Mrs. Frisbee is trying to understand how Jeremy got himself tied up in the fence. To do this, Mrs. Frisbee uses a WH question of why. She wants to know the reason why Jeremy is in the situation. This shows that Mrs. Frisbee is very curious and is always questioning. Mrs. Frisbee also uses the imperative or command form in the sentences,
Come down here.
And,
Don't argue.
The structure for the imperative or command form is base form of main verb, no subject. We understand the subject of commands to be you, but we do not need to write the subject when making the command. So instead of,
You come down here,
Mrs. Frisbee just says,
Come down here.
Mrs. Frisbee's mothering skills come out as she tries to help Jeremy. So she uses commands to tell Jeremy what to do. Thoughts of a character are just as important as what they say. If we know what a character thinks, this can help us understand what motivates the character. For example, before Mrs. Frisbee offers to help Jeremy, we are given some understanding of what she thinks about him.
Bird brain, said Mrs. Frisbee, and then recalled what her husband used to say. The size of the brain is no measure of its capacity.
Instead of using quotation marks that show speech, the author only uses verbs and commas to show what Mrs. Frisbee is thinking. The two verbs are thought and recalled. These verbs are used in the past tense to show Mrs. Frisbee already had these thoughts and to help with telling the story. Thought is the irregular past tense of think. Recalled is the regular past tense form of recall, which means to remember. Mrs. Frisbee thinks that Jeremy is not very smart for getting tied up in the fence. Then she remembers a saying her husband had about brain power. In this week's report, we looked at how to describe a character from a book. We considered how the author uses adjectives to describe Mrs. Frisbee's appearance. We can think about the character's talks with other characters, like how Mrs. Frisbee was questioning Jeremy, or how she used commands. We even looked at her thoughts and memories. Here is how I would describe Mrs. Frisbee so far with what we know about her. Mrs. Frisbee is a small brown field mouse and mother. She uses her sharp teeth when finding food for her children. Although Mrs. Frisbee is a curious mouse, she always questions the situation. She uses her mothering skills to help others in need. Let's end this report by continuing our homework assignment. Use your favorite character from a book. Try to find where the character is described. What adjectives are used to describe their appearance? Next, look at where they are speaking. Find those quotation marks. What are they saying? Find parts in the story where the character's thoughts are shown. What are they thinking or remembering? Write these sections down and send them to us at learningenglish@voanews.com. We may use your writing in a future report of Everyday Grammar. I'm Faith Perlow.
I'm Andrew Smith.
And I'm Jill Robbins.
Today on The Making of a Nation, we continue the story of the American Revolution. Here is Steve Ember.
The year was 1775. Colonists in Massachusetts had fought battles with British troops in the towns of Lexington and Concord. War had not been declared, but citizen soldiers in each of the 13 American colonies were ready to fight. Who was going to organize the colonists into an army? This was the first question that faced the Second Continental Congress when delegates met in May in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. The delegates decided that the man for the job was George Washington. He had experience fighting in the French and Indian War. He seemed to know more than any other colonist about being a military commander. The delegates elected him as commander-in-chief of the Continental Army. He accepted the position, but said he would not take any money for leading the new army. George Washington left Philadelphia for Massachusetts, where he took command on July 3rd, 1775.
He was tall, he was very elegant, very well put together.
Jane Gordon at the Massachusetts Historical Society says Washington looked very impressive.
It's very interesting because when he came to take command of the Continental Army, many of the New England soldiers were not quite sure what to make of this man who was, after all, from Virginia, not from New England. Washington won them over. His conduct, his grace, I think his discipline was extremely important.
Back in Philadelphia, the delegates to the Second Continental Congress made one more attempt to prevent war with Great Britain. They sent another message to King George. They asked him to consider their problems and try to find a solution. The king would not even read the message. You might wonder, why would the delegates try to prevent war if the people were ready to fight? The answer is that most of the members of the Congress and most of the colonists were not yet ready to break away from England. They continued to believe they could have greater self-government and still be part of the British Empire. Jane Gordon at the Massachusetts Historical Society says many colonists felt conflicted and confused about their identity.
they're Englishmen. They're still Englishmen, but they're not Englishmen. All along, what they've wanted is just to have the rights of Englishmen, and it doesn't seem to be possible under an old system.
A major battle took place in June of 1775, just 2 days after the delegates in Philadelphia chose George Washington as commander. It was the first major battle of the American Revolution. It was called the Battle of Bunker Hill, although it really involved two hills, Bunker and Breeds. Both are just across the Charles River from the city of Boston. Massachusetts soldiers dug positions on Breeds Hill. The British started to attack from across the river. The Americans had very little gunpowder. They were forced to wait until the British had crossed the river and were almost on top of them before they fired their guns. Their commander reportedly told them not to fire on the British until they saw the whites of their eyes. The British climbed the hill. The Americans fired. A second group of British soldiers climbed the hill. The Americans fired again. The third time, the British reached the top, but the Americans were gone. They had left because they had no more gunpowder. Peter Drummy, a librarian at the Massachusetts Historical Society, reads part of a letter that a young soldier wrote to his mother.
I was in the fort when the enemy came in, jumped over the wall, and ran half a mile, where balls, that is, musket balls, flew like hailstones, and cannon roared like thunder.
The British captured Breed's Hill, but Peter Drummy says the Americans still considered the battle a kind of victory.
The paradox is, even though the American forces are defeated and forced off the hill, nevertheless, the British casualties are so high that it is at least a moral victory.
Even the young American soldier who fled the battle wrote to his mother that he would continue fighting for American independence.
And in fact, that's probably what the British learned from this battle, that they could capture this hill at great cost, but the New England countryside is full of hills, and they couldn't capture them all back.
That battle also reduced whatever hope was left for a negotiated settlement. King George declared the colonies to be in open rebellion. The American colonists fought several battles against British troops in 1775. Yet the colonists were still not ready to declare war. Then, the following year, the British decided to use Hessian soldiers to fight against the colonists. Hessians were mostly German mercenaries who fought for anyone who paid them. The colonists feared these soldiers and hated the British for using them. In January of 1776, Thomas Paine published a document that strongly influenced the colonists. He named the pamphlet Common Sense. It attacked King George as well as the idea of a monarchy, a government led by a king or queen. The pamphlet called for independence. About 150,000 copies of Common Sense were sold in the colonies. Everyone talked about it. As a result, the Second Continental Congress began to act. It opened American ports to foreign shipping. It urged colonists to establish state governments and to write constitutions. On June 7, 1776, Virginia delegate Richard Henry Lee proposed a resolution for independence. The resolution was not approved immediately. Declaring independence was an extremely serious step. Signing such a document would make the delegates traitors to Britain. They would be killed if captured by the British. The delegates wanted the world to understand what they were doing and why. So they appointed a committee to write a document giving the reasons for their actions. One member of this committee was Thomas Jefferson of Virginia. He had already written a report criticizing the monarchy. So the other committee members asked him to write the new document. They said he was the best writer in the group. They were right. Jefferson was 33 years old. It took him 17 days to write the document. The Second Continental Congress approved it on July 4, 1776. It was America's Declaration of Independence. Historian Gordon Wood at Brown University says the Declaration was a message to the world.
They are trying to, I think, signal to the world, we are a new nation, we've broken away from this other nation. We're a separate nation, and we want recognition of our independence.
The Declaration of Independence begins with these words.
When in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another, and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation.
The Declaration goes on to say,
we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it and to institute new government.
The British believed that the Americans were violating British law. Jefferson argued that the British treatment of the American colonies violated the natural laws of God. This idea of natural law had been expressed by British and French philosophers more than 100 years earlier. Jefferson had studied these philosophers in school, but in writing the Declaration of Independence, he said the words came straight from his heart. The Declaration goes on to list 27 complaints against the king. There are complaints against taxes without the consent of the colonists and against the presence of British troops in the colonies. After the list, Jefferson went on to write this statement.
That these United Colonies are and of right ought to be free and independent states. That they are absolved from all allegiance to the British Crown, and that all political connection between them and the state of Great Britain is and ought to be totally dissolved. And that as free and independent states, they have the full power to levy war, conduct peace, contract alliances, establish commerce, and do all other acts and things which independent states may of right do.
Jefferson concluded the Declaration with a line that was meant to persuade the delegates to support the most serious step, revolution.
And for the support of this Declaration, with the firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor.
And that's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow to keep learning English through stories from around the world.